Today is April 18th, and I am back with Andy Chan for the second day of his Pew interview. So in reviewing the work that we did yesterday, I was reminded of a few follow-up questions that I wanted to ask you. And one goes back to the issue of this expectation that your parents had that you would all achieve in the educational field. And, you know, there are many forms that can take, from overt pressure on kids to just setting an example. And I was wondering how that was. How did you know that?
I think probably it was both by example and by actual active things that my parents did. So on their part as well as for us. So as I mentioned yesterday, you know, one of the major things they've done is that they've gone to school basically forever, as far as I can tell. It actually took a huge amount of effort to convince my parents to stop going to school over the last few years. And the second thing was that pretty much, you know, throughout our schooling, we were pretty much always participating in some academic aspect of schooling, whether that be at courses at the, they had, you know, a number of the junior colleges had courses for children over the summertime, you know, whether they be painting, art lessons, music lessons, music camp, art camp, math camp, etc. So we always participated in something every summer, which always meant that we were always, quote, in school in some form or another. So I think that kind of active planning on the part probably sunk in, that you always try to better yourself, whether it was in a structured manner or by yourself in an unstructured manner. So I think it's probably a little bit of both.
Were there any particular expectations about what you would do? I mean,
I don't think so. I mean, I always thought, I mean, my interests, again, were predominantly in the science field and science/math field. And I think that's always been reflective in part of where we sort of excelled in, and I think in part where you excel and become sort of the aspects that you have a greater interest in. Number two is that, you know, my both of my parents were also in fields that were more based on math and science. So I think it was a combination of those things that pushed us in one particular direction. But I didn't feel like there was any particular expectations as to what field, per se, that we did. And again, I think also that the exposure even that my parents had to the variety of fields was somewhat limited. And that while I didn't know what a physician scientist was or an academician was, I think similarly my parents didn't have a very good concept as to what that also entailed. The most remote, or the most, not more remote, but the closest interaction we had was that I have a cousin who was also a physician scientist, but he wasn't that much further in terms of his training, so that it wasn't like I already knew what a physician scientist did based on what he did. So again, I think all of us were sort of in the dark as to what kind of careers we were pursuing. And that actually came multiple times home in because my parents would always wonder when my training would end. Because it always seemed I was going to another additional level of training. Because again, training in both clinical and laboratory science, you know, obviously takes a huge amount of time.
Was did anybody in your family ever entertain the idea of not going to college?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. That was clearly, I think, an expectation. Mm-hmm. And I think it also was an expectation based on the general circle of individuals that one is acquainted with. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So again, in high school, you know, you have a particular circle of friends, and mm-hmm. all of them had the similar kinds of expectations. So it wasn't out of that, and it wasn't anything unusual, or I don't think it ever dawned on us that we would consider not going to college. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other thing that I was wondering about was, you know, we talked a little bit about how you, more or less, your Chinese got arrested at the age mm-hmm. of 7, and that you lost your ability to write and that mm-hmm. sort of thing.
Yes.
And one of the things that I think is interesting about all immigrant cultures here is that the next generation loses mm-hmm. some of that identity. And first of all, how connected do you feel to being Chinese?
Mm-hmm. I think that is a good observation. I think I don't feel that tied in to my heritage, mm-hmm. okay? Because I think what happens is that, especially the first generation immigrants come mm-hmm. over, and the major thing usually is to strive for something else that they didn't have, that we didn't have before. Mm-hmm. In this case, it was educational opportunity. And in which case, I think most, if not all, of one's energies are put into those directions. And the things that you obviously have, you really don't think of as things that you would potentially lose. Mm-hmm. But obviously, that's what happens. And as you pointed out, I think most of the immigrants do lose a lot of their own heritage because of the goals of trying to attain certain other things. So from that standpoint, I feel that, you know, I have lost part of my heritage. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, in the whole aspect of things, I would like to have not lost that part of the heritage. Mm-hmm. But again, because of the things that we do on a daily basis, I also find myself not having sufficient time mm-hmm. to go after and regain some of those mm-hmm. aspects of my life.
Mm-hmm. Was that an issue at all for your parents?
I can't tell. I'm sure, you know, rationalizing it, I think they, of course, I think would have liked to have seen me retain probably more of my heritage. But I think they were also involved in the same kind of issues that mm-hmm. I just discussed, mm-hmm. you know, which was they wanted us to attain a certain degree of excellence mm-hmm. at certain levels. And with it, of course, was that one loses certain mm-hmm. aspects of what one had already. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that they're that concerned about it. I think they're more concerned that we work too hard than necessarily that we've lost these particular aspects of our history.
Uh-huh.
I think, you know, if all things being equal, they would say absolutely. Uh-huh. I wish that, you know, we hadn't done this in terms of losing that part of our culture. But it doesn't seem to bother, at least I can't tell whether it bothers them a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that actually a colleague of mine who was Chinese told me was that there was a lot of pressure on her. She was born here, but her parents were from China. There was a lot of pressure on her to marry somebody Chinese. And mm-hmm. I know you mentioned that your wife is Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any pressure by your family?
I mean, there wasn't any pressure from my family.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe again because Hong Kong is not quite like China mm-hmm. in that it is mm-hmm. clearly a very westernized mm-hmm. city. Mm-hmm. And my parents have never commented on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether they would have,
uh-huh.
But they've never commented on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, it's just one's environment,
mm-hmm.
as to who one is exposed to and things, mm-hmm. like that, that leads one to a certain particular mm-hmm. situation.
Sure.
But that, again, wasn't a major factor in my decision making.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I want to also go back and touch on a little bit more about the MD-PhD program,
mm-hmm.
because I've heard lots of different comments from different scholars about the value or relative lack thereof, mm-hmm. of having an MD degree if you're going to be a basic scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what your perspective on mm-hmm. this kind of joint, the advantages and disadvantages mm-hmm. of doing something like mm-hmm. what you did.
Well, let me just discuss the disadvantages first. I mean, a disadvantage, obviously, is just a time issue, in that one goes through a variety of different additional durations of training into a certain aspect or certain career path.
Mm-hmm.
And one probably does not utilize it to the fullest extent. But again, the MD-PhD program is only one facet of the training. And again, many individuals, depending what their interests are, may go into different directions
mm-hmm.
at a variety of different points in the career.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, my training, for example, was to finish with the MD-PhD degree, complete my full clinical training before returning back to the laboratory. Other individuals will just obtain their MD-PhD training in school and really never obtain additional clinical training, mm-hmm. and actually go directly into the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, there are many different lengths of training and different kinds of training that can result from mm-hmm. this kind of path. So the downside, of course, I think is just a time issue.
Mm-hmm.
The advantages, actually, I think, are very dependent upon, can also be judged depending on what one's view is. If one values the clinical knowledge that one obtains, and I agree to some degree that not all the training is absolutely required, but nonetheless, I think an appreciation of what human disease is, and what the different aspects or subtleties of human diseases are actually allows one potentially to have certain insights based on one's mm-hmm. basic science research.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, for example, my research has been primarily in immunology. And my clinical training is in rheumatology. So this is clearly one of the aspects whereby I can many times easily relate what some of the basic science observations are in terms of the pathogenesis of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
That clearly is what has led to, not from my experience, but based on other people's experience, what has led to a variety of different insights that have led to products or to new discoveries in terms of the pathogenesis of disease. So I would agree that, yes, you don't need to be there, for example, to take care of patients being on call every third night or fourth night, depending what one wants to do. But yet at the same time, I think having that type of insight is helpful,
mm-hmm.
if one wants to be able to tie the clinical aspect of disease into the basics, mm-hmm. Into the basic science work. In terms of the clinical training, I think the other advantage is that you are probably one of the few people that's going to be able to meld or be able to walk between the basic scientists and the translational medicine or clinical scientists. And that, I think, is extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, a good scientist should be able to meld between or be able to take observations in one field and be able to cross-fertilize another field, an outstanding physician scientist or well-trained physician scientist should also be able to bridge the bedside aspects of medicine and the bench sides of medicine. Mm-hmm. And if one basically just continues focusing on one aspect or the other, I think then we would be missing a lot of the interplay between the two fields or between the two disciplines, which I think is important. So without saying that, you know, this is clearly what everybody has to do, I think it's still a wonderful opportunity to allow oneself to go between both fields. Now, what you can make an argument as to whether it's worth all the time in terms of training. But again, it also depends on whether one enjoys doing that kind of work. Some people don't like taking care of patients. Others do. So I think it's very much based on what one wants to do eventually, what kind of research one wants to do, and what are the kinds of interests they have. I think that the position of a physician scientist is important in that one has to be able to relate to both aspects of science. And hence another important role for why we need physician scientists is really to train additional individuals who can do that. So I think the teaching responsibilities and the mentorship of those individuals also likewise becomes extremely important. Because again, you are then the basis for the teaching and hopefully the generation, the next generation of scientists. So I think for me, I'm biased, obviously, because I like doing both. But I think those are the advantages. The disadvantages is that you just don't get to sleep as much because you're, you know, because of the clinical responsibilities and the time issue.
Well, the example that springs to my mind about being able to sort of see the basic science side and the clinical side is the work that you did with the SCID patients, missing the, what was it, the ZAP 70?
Right. So again, that's a lot of serendipity. We weren't in a position to exactly go out to screen children with immunodeficiencies. But we happened to have to be in a situation where we actually had those cells sitting in the freezer, and that initial observation sort of taught me a lesson as to how to approach the next time that we would be in a similar position. So, having described the children with mutations in the ZAP70 gene that have severe combined immunodeficiency, the next time, which was now 1998, when we cloned out and discovered the BLNK linker protein, it was obvious to me that that was a disease to look at for a counterpart in the human in human disease. Now, that's not to say if I didn't have it the first time, and you know, and obviously I'm not trained in pediatrics, we wouldn't have done it. But I think having the clinical training, one, I think at least sees or increases the potential importance or recognizes the potential importance of understanding that kind of phenomenon. And hence one puts probably a little bit more effort in trying to attack questions of that type. So I think that's basically the different, you know, the insights that one takes. You know, I think the question in the end is whether that should really require, or whether that is worth, you know, 5 or 6 additional years of clinical training. And I think with that, you know, you've seen the aging of the young scientists. Young scientists aren't young anymore when they start. But this has been a progressive increase, you know, in the average age of PIs for the first R01.
Well, some of that has to do with not being able to get jobs, but we're going to discuss that in length. One other thing you mentioned yesterday was that you loved internship and residency, and that's not everyone's experience. So tell me what you loved, how you loved it.
What one hears is always that the internship and residency is sort of a drudgery. But that, I think that in part depends on how one approaches it.
Mm-hmm.
So when I began my internship, maybe this was just naivety or the fact that I only had one clinical year versus two clinical years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it also depends on what one previously's training is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So actually, I found internship to be less challenging than my graduate work in the laboratory.
Less challenging mentally or
less
time-wise?
Clearly, both.
Both.
On both.
Okay.
Okay. Now, while I spent more hours physically in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
It was less mentally challenging because when you were done, at the end of the day or the end of the rotation, you were done. You signed out. You pretty much had some ideas that all your patients were pretty well, had been taken care of. You may go home and look up certain aspects of things which were already known. Okay, so you're
mm-hmm.
basically looking through differential diagnosis to make sure you hadn't missed something,
mm-hmm.
or entertaining just or reading up on the proposed pathogenesis of certain disease.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not the same kind of thinking that one does in laboratory, where at the end of the day, that's the beginning of the day,
mm-hmm.
which is, yes, you finished the physical aspects of your lab work, but now you also have to contemplate, well, what does that result mean? What new types of experiments should one think about in terms of developing new paradigms
mm-hmm.
for your field?
Mm-hmm.
This is just not reading and learning,
mm-hmm.
okay? This is reading, synthesizing,
mm-hmm.
and reinventing.
Mm-hmm.
So from a mental standpoint, it was much more demanding in the laboratory than it was, you know,
uh-huh.
during clinical training. So physically, it was more demanding as an intern because mm-hmm. you had to stay up more number of hours. You know, you would get interrupted. You would be called at 2 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock mm-hmm. in the morning because somebody had a temperature or somebody wasn't feeling well, somebody was having chest pain, etc. But you knew how to take care of those kind of situations. It was a very straightforward things that you would
mm-hmm.
think about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody spikes the temperature, you know, what are they in here for? Are they infected? Do they have another source of infection? Are they not responding to the antibiotics? Is this a drug fever? Is this some connective tissue disease? The workup was very, very standard, and you could pretty much do it by rote memory.
Mm-hmm.
So from that standpoint, it was much more mentally challenging in the laboratory than it was as, mm-hmm. as an intern. So from that, so hence, the internship was easy, relatively speaking.
Uh-huh.
It was physically demanding.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of mentally challenging, it was not mentally challenging. And the other thing was that I liked taking care of patients.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I liked interacting with the patients. I liked mm-hmm. trying to figure out what the patient had. So from that standpoint, it was fun. It was
mm-hmm.
challenging. You interact with the people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You interacted with your colleagues
mm-hmm.
all the time. So from that, it's the internship actually, while it was physically challenging, wasn't as demanding as previous
mm-hmm.
you know, times, and that was doing something that I enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then during your residency, it's less physically challenging because now the intern's doing basically all the
right.
stat work.
Right.
But then you had the responsibility of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I enjoyed teaching also.
Mm-hmm.
So from that standpoint also, it was an additional responsibility that was thrust upon you that I enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
So every single point in my training, they were giving me more things to do that I enjoyed.
Uh-huh.
So, I enjoyed all of it.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you told me to go back to becoming an intern, I don't think I would be physically capable, at least of being an intern again. At least,
mm-hmm.
You know, the kind of hours that people
mm-hmm.
were spending
sure.
In those days. I mean, it's actually interesting because during my internship, we had to fill out these time cards to estimate the number of hours we actually had spent in the hospital for Medicare reimbursement or something like that.
And typically, we would put anywhere from 80 to 120 hours per week. Mm-hmm. I mean, hundreds of hours per week was not was not unusual. And by and large, people just didn't complain. Mm-hmm. People, this is the expectation, this is how you worked, mm-hmm. and that's what you did. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed it for a variety of different reasons, mm-hmm. But part of it probably was the novelty, mm-hmm. part of it was that I was doing things that I liked to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I'm trying to remember who it was that said it about, I read your recommendations for the pew from different people, and mm-hmm. I think it was John Atkinson said that you were a legendary figure staff.
We enjoyed our work.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an experience. It's actually a very binding experience for mm-hmm. everybody that's involved, because you know these are people that you spend all your life with, basically.
Sure.
This was your social circle in part.
Right. Now, had you met your wife by this time?
No. I met my wife during my residency. So uh-huh. she was from Alabama, from UAB, came up here and began her residency the same year
we were. So she was a physician.
So she was a physician, right? Mm-hmm. So both of us were interns together.
I see. In the same internal medicine?
In the same
yeah.
class.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we got married during our junior resident year. So we
so
had known each
have
other
been
for 2 years.
Years later.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
She actually jokes to this day, she can't quite figure out how it happened that we ended up married, because we were on call every third night. Uh-huh. We did not have coordinated calls. So one of us was always post-call, the other one was pre-call.
Right. Right.
But it all worked out.
Yeah. Okay. So what does she do now?
She is a academic physician also at Washington University. She's in the Division of Gastroenterology.
Uh-huh.
And she does pretty much 85% clinical, has 85% clinical responsibilities, about another 15% teaching and administrative responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why but she enjoys it, that combination also.
Well, luckily, there's a place for everybody and everybody's personality, right?
No, I think, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, actually, I want to spend some time talking about all these things that you do now,
mm-hmm.
these PI responsibilities, and there are many, I know. Let's start with teaching, because you already alluded to the fact that you enjoy teaching.
Mm-hmm.
How much teaching do you actually have to do
mm-hmm.
here?
Well, I mean, I think teaching is a very, very general and loose term.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so there is classroom teaching,
mm-hmm.
And this actually I do very, a very small number of hours. I teach in the classroom probably no more than a total of about 12 hours a year, mm-hmm. 12 lecture hours per year.
Would this be to medical students or
it's
graduate students?
Predominantly to graduate students.
Graduate students, okay.
So these are either just lecture courses to immunology students, graduate students, and or discussion in advanced topics, lecture type of, not lecture, but faculty sponsors of journal clubs.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the sort of the didactic type of sessions.
Mm-hmm.
There's also teaching responsibilities when I attend on the medicine service as well as the rheumatology service. While part of my responsibilities, obviously, is to ensure that the care that's being given by the house staff and the fellows are outstanding, part of it also, the teaching responsibilities also to relate not only the diagnostic and therapeutic implications of the patient's case, but part of the responsibility also relates to trying to discuss basic science developments as it relates to the case.
Mm-hmm.
or basic science developments as it relates to general medicine, depending on how much time we have. Mm-hmm. So those are the two most straightforward type of teaching responsibilities that we have. And then to a more looser extent, you know, teaching occurs daily. Mm-hmm. So for example, I mean, I have graduate students, rotation students, postdoctoral fellows, clinical fellows in my laboratory. So their part of it is a teaching responsibility because we have to discuss, you know, how does one interpret experiments, how one evaluates data, how one evaluates other people's published data, what are the implications of other published data in terms of your studies. Mm-hmm. So I think that's also a teaching responsibility. Mm-hmm. And then there's also, for example, teaching by example. Mm-hmm. And that is when one is at seminars, one asks questions, sometimes you know, just because one wants to know the answer, but also one also asks questions, even though it might be a stupid question, to make a point that asking stupid questions is not a bad way of trying to think. Mm-hmm. Okay? So many times we have seminars which are very informal, for which everybody's just sitting there like a log. Mm-hmm. And just to instigate discussion at some level, mm-hmm. one either takes a just an unusual stance mm-hmm. on a particular situation. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily that one believes in it, but so that one can instigate some sort of dialogue or discussion amongst the group. So actually, you know, teaching is can have many, many different types of connotations, mm-hmm. and I actually see that I view actually many of the things that I do on a daily basis as sort of a teaching exercise. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that, depending how you define it, can range from only, you know, 20 hours, 24 hours a year to 365 days a week.
A week, yeah. Okay. When you do the more formal type of teaching, mm-hmm. What kinds of preparations do you have to go through for that, or do you anymore? Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes the first year it's a lot, and then after that it's...
Yeah, so I'm fortunate enough to actually, in most of the formal teaching that I responsibilities that I have, they're pretty much in my area of expertise. So that you're absolutely right. The first 2 years of teaching was a huge amount of work just to prepare mm-hmm. all the handouts, the transparencies, mm-hmm. to be able to synthesize and present a particular topic in a logical and concise mm-hmm. manner. Mm-hmm. And then the subsequent years, you know, for me to give four 1 hour series on T cell receptor activation in immunology, I probably spend an additional somewhere between 4 to 8 hours redoing the handout and redoing the talk based on additional information that has been mm-hmm. obtained over the past year.
This is a one-hour talk.
This is a four one-hour
talks.
Lectures, okay. That series that I give okay. over a week and a half. But in doing so, of course, one has to think about, well, what are the major messages that I want to mm-hmm. put through? Because mm-hmm. otherwise, I can just accumulate 4 hours 1 year, 8 hours 1 year, 12 hours 1 year. Okay, so one has to come back and say, okay, what are the things I'm going to take out, what are the things I'm going to put in, and why is it that I'm going to put it in this particular way? Mm-hmm. So that at the end of the 4 hours, at the end of each hour, the students have a concise view as to what it is that I tried to teach them. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think teaching is an extremely demanding and mm-hmm. exhausting task. I mean, after I give every lecture, I am just exhausted for the next 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Because you're always thinking, okay, what is the next major topic that I'm going to think about, right. that I'm going to talk about, and be sort of two steps ahead. Because mm-hmm. Again, you only give this lecture once a year. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's actually easier, for example, for me to give a standard research talk, because I give that 3-4 times a month. I can go basically go on autopilot sometimes, and, right. and you know, and just come back at the end of the session and answer questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it is a huge endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important not only to teach that section, but it also gives an example to the students of how to teach,
mm-hmm.
which is something that we're not taught, you know, as a postdoctoral fellow. And there are lots of things that I've done as a PI in the last 6 years that, you know, for which we have no formal instruction in. And each one of those takes a huge amount of time mm-hmm. to do it correctly.
Right. Right. Well, you mentioned earlier that this idea of mentoring other students who are on the same path you're on was very important to you.
I think mentoring, you know, especially the students as well as trainees that are in my laboratory,
yeah.
as well as
yeah.
other individuals, who, you know,
right.
That are interested in my input are all important.
Mm-hmm.
One of the major things that I've learned, you know, in the brief 6 years that I've been around is not everyone is built in the same mode, nor do they hold the same goals as you
mm-hmm.
do.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So coming out of postdoctoral fellowship, you know, you had an extremely focused view of what one should do.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, I was in happened to be in a laboratory where everyone in that particular laboratory had very, very similar goals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were 12 of us there, all of whom felt that what we're here to do is outstanding science.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us complained. None of us thought about anything else except for the science.
Mm-hmm.
And when you train in a place like that for 3 to 4 years, that's what you expect everybody to be at.
Mm-hmm.
And once you remove yourself from that group, I soon realized that, well, that's not true for everyone. That actually is probably only true for a very small minority of individuals amongst even the general scientific population.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think, was one of the startling things that I discovered
mm-hmm.
Soon after I became a PI.
Mm-hmm.
One of many.
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I was going to ask you if you think students have changed or
mm-hmm.
over the years. You know, you know, you're getting older when you start saying, "Boy, students have changed."
No,
when
I've said
I was
that
a
for
student.
The last 6 years.
Yeah.
That students have changed.
In what way?
Students have changed, and I don't necessarily think this is good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's just different. First of all, students actually are much more aware of the real world than we were
mm-hmm.
when I was a graduate student. There are always, for students now, there is always an agenda.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and again, I'm not saying that that's necessarily good or bad, but there is mm-hmm. always an agenda aside from science. It's not just whether this is a good question and you want to know what the answer is, but it's what it's at the end of the pay line. Not scientifically, but in terms of potential personal gain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think students nowadays weigh much more these issues that we never thought about as students. I mean, when I was a graduate student, and you know, I lived with two other graduate students at the time, all of us were in the MD-PhD program, we would come to the lab. We would do our work, we'd think about what the next sets of experiments were, and at a certain time, your boss would say, "It's time for you to graduate." I said, "Okay, time to graduate." And now the students are very much different, and I'm generalizing again, but there's mm-hmm. a greater concern of, well, if I do this experiment, what is it it's going to afford me after I do the experiment?
Mm-hmm.
If I undertake this higher risk project, how might it pay off for me 5 years from now?
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're much more aware of what the consequences are,
mm-hmm.
Which is good as well as bad,
mm-hmm.
because I think what it does, the good side is that, you know, they're always thinking about what the consequences are. The bad side then is that they don't take the risks
mm-hmm.
because the risk is too high.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is becomes a major difference.
Mm-hmm. Now,
there, you know, there are also a lot more opportunities for students now mm-hmm. than there were, you know, 10, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. In that, you know, they can go and join a analyst group speculating in stocks and make more than an assistant professor.
Mm-hmm.
So why should they go on to another 3 or 4 years of postdoctoral fellowship?
Mm-hmm.
They can go to law school, mm-hmm. okay, and then become a biotechnology advisor or a whatever advisor to mm-hmm. to a law group and mm-hmm. make substantial amounts of money.
Mm-hmm.
So what I see is actually the, I mean, this is happening in science in general. You know, this is the commercialization of science as it has occurred over the last 10, 15 years,
mm-hmm.
is that everybody wants the patents, everybody wants the starter companies, everybody wants to be a millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
And that clearly has affected the way that students as well as trainees think about their own training.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes better for the better and sometimes for the worse.
Mm-hmm.
It's just different.
Mm-hmm. Well, it actually brings up an ethical question, one of many,
mm-hmm.
Which is, should people be able to patent scientific ideas?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the issue of patenting all relates to, in part, well, it relates to drug discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And if we didn't have patents, the argument has been made, then there would be no development of drugs. And that may well be the case. I mean, clearly the United States has a huge lead in terms of drug discovery as compared to other countries. So from a purely ethical view, I would say no, they shouldn't do that. From a purely realistic view, I think you have to give them certain patentable ideas or certain patent rights so that they will take the risk in developing, you know, the appropriate drugs or testing which of the targets may be reasonable targets for drug discovery.
Mm-hmm.
If we didn't have that, I think the drug discovery, at least in terms of the private sector, would be very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
And the academic sector is not in a position to develop drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Several universities or a few universities have tried.
Mm-hmm.
But usually that has not been borne out in anything that's been successful.
Mm-hmm.
So I think out of necessity, realistically, we have to have those kinds of opportunities for drug companies to patent ideas
mm-hmm.
and to patent molecules.
Mm-hmm.
Whether academicians should do that, I think is a different issue.
Mm-hmm.
That's a harder issue to address. You know, one argument that's been made is that if the academician discovers a molecule, patents it, or doesn't, if they don't patent it, then obviously somebody else is going to patent it.
Mm-hmm.
If in a purely academic lab, that really shouldn't make a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
But again, in reality, of most situations, it's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
And one can probably, in a way, justify it by saying, well, you know, if a drug company is willing to pay a certain amount of licensing dollars or royalties to a laboratory for the use of a certain type of reagent or certain type of knowledge, then if that money goes back to the laboratory,
mm-hmm.
that probably is a good use of funds.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are a zillion type of, you know, individual situations that we could discuss endlessly, which we have done in many of our ethics courses.
Right. Let me flip the table.